You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at the Diplomat, and joining me today is Shannon Tiazi, our editor for all things China. Thanks for joining me, Shannon.
Always a pleasure, Ankit.
The fifth plenum of the 18th Communist Party's Central Committee in China just wrapped up, resulting in an important range of proclamations, including a 13th five-year plan. Now, the committee's plenums are always important events for gauging the trajectory of the modern Chinese state for those of us observing it from the outside. Usually, the State Council, uses these as, a kind of a bellwether of where the country ought to be going. The five-year plans are, China's preferred model of charting out its own growth plans. In 2010, at that plenum, we saw the five-year plan put forward that essentially determined that China would shift away from its previous economic model, which emphasized investment-led growth, to a more consumption-led demand-side model of growth. So with this fifth plenum, I think we've seen a lot of interesting changes in China. Mostly it's been a re-emphasis of what we saw at the third plenum, but Shannon's been reporting on this in some detail, so I wanted to get her opinion on what we saw last week out of the fifth plenum. So the first and major change that I'd like to talk about, Shannon, is something that's been at the top of the mainstream media news cycle across the world, which is the end to China's infamous one-child policy. Now, the one-child policy has received a lot of criticism from many people in the West. It's been seen as sort of an infringement on personal freedoms and human rights in China. It's essentially the intrusion of the state on a very private sphere of life, which is the decision on how many children to have. And we can talk a bit about, the effectiveness of that. But, for China, the one-child policy has essentially been lifted under the guise, at least going by the communique of the plenum, that, China is facing an aging population and a demographic crisis. So this policy had overstayed its welcome, and it was time to remove it. In fact, if you look at the data, in the late 1970s, when the policy was put into place, births per 1,000 people in China were at about 38, and today they stand at about 12. So that's a dramatic decrease in overall fertility. But there is more nuance to that argument. But first, Shannon, can you tell us a bit about why the party decided to make the call on removing the one-child policy with this five-year plan, and we didn't see it, maybe 5 years earlier? Why now?
They've been slowly moving toward this for a long time. This is not a problem that the rest of the world has noticed, but the Chinese Communist Party has somehow completely missed. Everyone has known China has bad demographics, and they are going to start moving into a situation where they have a very low birth rate. Their working age population is declining, and their retired elderly population is growing. These numbers are concerning. The problem is you get this sort of bureaucratic inertia that once you have this policy in place, it's very hard to get rid of. And I mentioned some of the specifics a bit more in the articles I've written about it. But one thing is that particularly local governments make a lot of money from the fines that they can apply to people who are having second children. And each particular locality gets to set its own fine structure. Some of them who might want to encourage second children kind of tacitly, they have very low, very reasonable fines, but some of them just are gouging people. And it's, at least $3 billion a year in terms of income for these local governments from enforcing this policy. So that's part of it. You also had this massive bureaucracy in place that basically their raison d'etre was to enforce this law. And they started dismantling that when Xi first came to power in 2012. They announced, okay, we're scrapping this ministry, we're folding it into the Ministry of Health. So that, I think, was really the signal that this policy is officially on its way out, because they got rid of the family planning ministry.
Yeah. Does this have anything to do with the, anti-corruption efforts by Xi Jinping? I mean, it sounded like when you're talking about price gouging and, gouging people for fines, that sounds like a form of corruption. Is that a concern?
I've never seen the two directly linked, but I think the overarching theme is that she wants to get rid of the people who are working for personal gain and not for the good of the country. And that's always how he frames his anti-corruption drive. And that's very much a problem when it comes to the one-child policy, is you have people who want to keep it in place, knowing full well that it's terrible for China as a nation, because it benefits them personally or benefits their local government, which they're a part of. So I mean, it's It's not corruption in the sense of people taking bribes, although that certainly happens. It's just that these localities have set their fines at an exorbitantly high rate, and it's all perfectly legal. They're allowed to do that. The provinces are given leeway to set their fines where they want. So, yeah, I haven't seen this explicitly tied to corruption the way the anti-corruption drive is much more focused on state-owned enterprises and the connection between business interests and the government ministries.
Got it. And with the new policy, I should clarify that it's not a wholesale lifting of the one-child policy. Essentially, married couples can now have two children, right? It's
Yes,
not
and I
a
think that's an important point because all of the human rights concerns that you have about the government's intervening in people's family decisions, those are all still there. They didn't get rid of this policy, they just changed it to a two-child policy.
Right, so that's some of the nuance that I think we haven't been seeing in a lot of the mainstream headlines here in the West, at least. We've been seeing a lot about China lifting its one-child policy, which sounds like great news, but you still do have those issues lingering. Speaking of Shannon, I want to talk a bit about the effectiveness of the actual one-child policy, which has been a topic of debate in the West. Just yesterday, Amartya Sen, famous Nobel laureate economist, wrote in the Times, essentially making the case, and he hasn't been the only one. Obviously, there's been a lot of people arguing this that the one-child policy was put into place at a time when China was already growing. Birth rates were already dropping before the policy in the late 1960s, even, and the policy essentially accelerated, existing trends in some way. But the bigger driving force of dropping fertility for Chinese women was, simply the fact that economic growth led to women working more, making more money. Which generally, if you look at other countries, even in Asia, notable examples being Japan and South Korea, you see dropping fertility rates there as well. So, what's your perception of this? I mean, did the one-child policy actually work for China, and did it exacerbate a problem?
Yeah, I wrote a piece saying China ending its one-child policy isn't that big of a deal, which I think already, spoiler alert, tells you how I feel about this. I think the one-child policy prevented a lot of births back when it was put in place. But China is now becoming a developed country. And certain, if you look at China as a whole, I think you can say it's still developing. You still have very low per capita income. But if you look at certain segments of China, particularly the East Coast, that's a developed society. Beijing, Shanghai, Tianjin, Guangzhou, these are places where people are basically living a developed lifestyle. And with that comes a much lower fertility rate. People just are less interested in having large families once they reach a certain level of economic development. And that we've seen that around the world. It's something that the Western world is dealing with. It's something that Japan and South Korea are dealing with. It just seems to be kind of a general social trend. And as you said, a big part of that is you have women who are entering the workforce and they're interested in their careers, they're waiting to get married longer because they're getting higher education. So in that sense, I think the one child policy has not really been meaningful for a lot of people for a long time. And obviously you have these horrific stories of forced abortions and sterilizations happening, and there are serious reasons for concern about this policy. And I don't want to downplay that. But I think the ultimate truth is that a lot of people who were able to have second children, because there were a lot of loopholes in this policy, simply don't want one. And we saw in 2013, China said, okay, any married couple that one of the partners is an only child, you're allowed to have two children, which is, a massive amount of couples. Some experts said that's up to 20 million couples who are going to be allowed to have a second child now. And by about 2 years later, they had less than 2 million couples who had actually taken advantage of this policy. And you do the little interviews, person-to-person interviews, which may be not reflective of the broader society, but people are saying the same things, which is it's really expensive to raise a child. We don't have the money to raise a second child. We're not interested in raising a second child. So I think you're not going to see a massive baby boom from China ending this policy, partially because it so had so many loopholes that it barely applied to people anymore, and partially because people just aren't that interested overall in having a second child. And that means that China's low fertility rate is natural at this point. It's around 1.5 children per woman per lifetime at this point. And that's very similar to what we see in the rest of the developed world.
Yeah, and I don't think China is immune to those broader economic trends, as you said. Just one final social issue, Shannon, before we turn over to economic. I guess it's actually both an economic and a social issue. I mean, it's certainly a fiscal issue, which is the issue of social security. Part of the consequence of a rapidly aging population is that you have a large swath of China interested in social security because intra-family transfers of income in old age, which have tended to be more popular in Asian countries where there's, sort of inter-family financial cohesion in many ways is starting to prove inefficient. So, can you talk a bit about the Social Security issue since that was one of the outcomes of the plenum? And I'd love to learn more about that.
Sure. So China's social security system is very complicated and very sort of ad hoc. You have people who get social security from their employment, and you have this sort of maze of different systems at the provincial and local level where local governments are offering social security to people. And there are these huge discrepancies, particularly one that really upsets people in China is the huge discrepancies between people's social security when they work for a private company and when they work for a public state company. They want those systems to be more or less equal, and right now they're very unbalanced. So ch what China announced after the fifth plenum is that they are going to, for the first time, guarantee old age insurance to every single elderly person in China, and they're going to be paying for that using state funds. There aren't a lot of details right now on what that actually looks like. So is China just going to be filling in the gaps and saying, okay, the people who fell through the cracks of the existing systems, those are the people the state's going to cover? Or is there going to be a unified state system, which would obviously take a lot more planning and a lot more work to overhaul what they have in place now? But this has been a major concern for people, and so I think it's a major step forward for China. Xinhua did an online survey, which all sorts of caveats with both Xinhua and with online surveys, but still interesting to note that this issue, the social security issue, was second only to environmental concerns by a, one-tenth of a percentage point in terms of the number of people who saw it as a top priority going into the fifth plenum. I think it was 73.7% were concerned about social security, and 73.8% were concerned about environmental issues. And environmental issues get talked about a lot in terms of this is something that the government needs to fix, or it could face massive, popular discontent and a threat to its legitimacy. You don't hear so much about social security in the same way, but it's an equally important issue for people. This is something that actually touches on the daily lives of families, of average people. And if they feel like the government's not looking out for them and not taking care of them, that's a big problem. And so the CCP is moving to fix that by saying we are going to guarantee old age insurance. The question obviously is it sustainable? I mean, here in America, we have all sorts of debates over how to actually keep funding our Social Security program as the people who are taking money out of it grow and the people who are putting money into it decline in population. And China is going to be facing some of the same issues. It'll be interesting to see what sort of strategy they have for dealing with that.
Yeah, and China doesn't quite have the fiscal capacity that the United States enjoys with the dollar as the global reserve currency. So I think they'll be a little bit more limited in how they can expand this program. Okay, Shannon, let's talk a bit about economic issues before we bring the podcast to a close. Like I said earlier, with the third plenum 2 years ago, we saw a commitment for China to continue its transition away from an export-reliant, investment-focused economy to one more based on consumption, innovation, and emphasizing the service industry instead of manufacturing. And the fifth plenum, emphasized a lot of these points. In fact, even before the fifth plenum, in the weeks leading up to it, we saw the State Council issue a communique on state-owned enterprise reform, which is something international investors and other people have been looking for a long time. In terms of the big takeaways on economics from the fifth plenum, is there anything really new that we saw that wasn't something that was implemented into the 13th 50-year plan, a 5-year plan, that wasn't mentioned at the third plenum?
I don't think there was anything new in the sense of, well, we've never seen this before, but I still think it's very important because this is the plenum that is basically solidifying the 13th 5-year plan. And we haven't seen all the details yet. They haven't issued an official blueprint of the 5-year plan yet, but everyone knows that's what they were talking about at the fifth plenum. And so every announcement coming out of the fifth plenum implies a connection to the 5-year plan. So they're really sending a strong signal that everything we talked about at the third plenum in 2013, boosting innovation, having an economy that's reliant on consumption and the service industry, having the market play a larger role in the economy, being more open to foreign investment, all of that stuff is going to be put into the 13th 5-year plan, which is the plan that sets all of China's goals from 2016 to 2020. So that, I think, legitimizes those goals even beyond having them in an official third plenum document. It's because it's going to be set in stone that, they might set a certain percentage. We want X percentage of our GDP to come from consumption, and they're going to have to try and hit that target on the head. What was interesting for me is that they've had this tension all along of saying we're going to rebalance and restructure our economy and move towards sustainable growth and not worry so much about the speed of growth, but also say we're going to maintain medium to high economic growth. So they're both saying, we're not going to care so much about GDP growth and saying we're going to care about GDP growth. And you have that tension in the fifth plenum as well. They said we are going to move toward innovation. We're going to move toward consumption. We're going to move away from our current model. But we are also going to stand fast to our goal of doubling our national GDP from 2010 figures by 2020, which is just an amazingly ambitious goal. And to do that, according to sort of leaked anonymous sourcing, Premier Li Keqiang said China has to grow at least 6.5% until 2020 to reach that goal. So it seems like they've set themselves a very hard floor. If they want to achieve this goal, which is massively tied into their legitimacy, because that's how they've defined telling people we're going to have a moderately prosperous society. They said doubling our 2010 GDP, that's how we get there. So if they don't get there, it's a huge problem. And that means that if it looks like their growth is going to fall below that magic number of 6.5%, what are you going to do? Are you going to fall back into the old bad habits of saying, okay, the government's just going to pump a ton of investment money in to, for example, our infrastructure, construction industries? Because that's not going to be connected well with your broader goals of rebalancing your economy and making it less dependent on investment from the government. So they're going to have to walk a tightrope between these two things moving forward for sure. And it's going to be very interesting to see if push comes to shove, which of them wins out.
Yeah, I mean, just to talk a bit about the foreign investors and how they've been looking at China. I mean, the 6.5 number has, there's been a lot of, at least leading up to the plenum, there was a lot of speculation. Would it be 6.5? Would it be 6? Would it be 7? And, the lower the number, that would have satisfied the kinds of people who want to see China take on structural reform, which would sacrifice some short-term growth in order for longer-term stability and sustainability, as opposed to, the more, bullish community, which would just like to see high growth rates out of China, through 2020. And it seems like, the CCP itself is trying to keep both of those groups happy, but I think you're right. I think it's going to prove to be an incredibly ambitious goal. I mean, I'm sure next year we'll see a 6.6% growth rate announced across all the quarters, since China has been known to just beat its targets by 0.1, coincidentally almost. I won't go into the details of that, but I think it's certainly going to be an ambitious objective for them. Shannon, thanks a lot for joining me today.
Sure, always a pleasure to talk to you, Ankit.
And if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, do leave us a review on iTunes and make sure that you subscribe to keep abreast of new episodes. Thank you.